Hello, and thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Elder. I work at Joint State Government Commission, which is a nonpartisan research office for the Pennsylvania Legislature. Here at Joint State, Glenn Passowitz is our executive director. Glenn, would you give us an introduction into the policy topic that we're going to be discussing today?
Sure, Susan. This episode of our podcast is about the new report on warm handoffs in Pennsylvania, which was authorized by House Resolution 216, which was sponsored by Representative Polenchak. As everyone is aware, substance use disorders is one of the most harmful personal health and public health threats that we're facing. The report focuses on a particular aspect of the coordination of care, and that is the process of moving a person from one type of care to the next, which is referred to as a warm handoff. The report was written in collaboration with both a legislative task force that included four members of the House of Representatives and an advisory committee that included a broad range of experts from law enforcement to emergency room doctors to treatment providers to insurers.
Thanks, Glenn. We have several other Joint State staff members here with us today. We're going to take a quick moment and introduce them. Brian DeWalt is our co-host and audio engineer.
Hi, Susan.
We also have Helen Conjana, who's the project manager.
Hello, good to be with you, Susan.
So let's dive into the discussion now with Susan, Brian, and Helen.
Helen, can you describe or can you explain what warm handoff for a drug overdose means?
Basically, a warm handoff for a drug overdose means the process of transitioning a patient with substance use disorder from an intercept point, such as an emergency department, to a treatment provider once the patient is stable. Warm handoffs process is not limited to opioids. It got a lot of attention due to the opioid epidemic, but it is not really limited to this particular substance. It is not limited to the emergency department either. It's very common when it happens with overdoses, which can actually occur at a person's home and the responder is someone who just provides first response to accidents like this. Warm handoffs can also be understood more broadly when we are talking about transferring patient from one level of care or one place of care to another one. A good example would be, say, a person who is incarcerated. If he has a substance use disorder and the treatment is started in prison, and then once he's released, he is connected with the local provider so he could continue with this treatment. That would be a warm handoff as well. And we certainly need to think of a warm handoff as just a step in providing general substance use treatment. I could say that warm handoffs are particularly important after an overdose, and this is where they are mostly used. An overdose is a situation in which an individual is in a state requiring emergency medical intervention as a result of the use of drugs or alcohol. When overdose happens, obviously different measures may be needed to help a patient medically. Overdoses, as shown by some of the studies, very often repeat. 40% of patients who received hospital care for opioid-related overdose did not get any follow-up services within a month after hospitalization. At the same time, 62% had at least one prior overdose. 22% had at least two prior overdoses, and 17% had experienced 3 to 6 prior overdoses. If warm handoffs can prevent those repeat overdoses, that would in itself be a huge impact.
You mentioned first responders. I was wondering, can you tell us about any other parties that might be involved in the warm handoff process?
Thank you for your question, Brian. And it is really a very important question, because one of the things that make warm handoffs so complicated is that they involve a lot of the parties. Just look at it, what you need for a successful warm handoff. First of all, you need the emergency department staff who are already overworked and busy and obviously focused on saving their patients' lives. They need to take an additional step to inform somebody that a particular patient is in need of continued treatment if they decide that. This is where they can contact one of the local agencies who would help them with establishing that connection. And those would be single county authorities, which are agencies run by the Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs in Pennsylvania, or the Centers of Excellence, which are run by the Department of Human Services. And one of those agencies would supply a contact represented by the so-called Certified Recovery Specialist, a CRS. That person, CRS, is usually someone who has already had his or her own experience with drugs. So she can establish a connection with the patient based on her own experience. She can be supportive, she can understand his problems, and she will also know how to connect him with other agencies where he would get help. A very important step in the warm handoff process is the assessment of the patient's needs. Not everyone needs to be hospitalized or sent to a facility where he should be all the time. Some need detoxification, some need something else. So it's important to assess the proper level of care and then establish the connection, which means yet another thing, that there should be enough providers at different levels who would actually be able to accept the patient. Of course, insurance coverage varies, and one of the great things single county authorities do is that they help the patient to find some sort of coverage that he could use, and centers of excellence would take care of the patients who are on Medicaid. With all this, speed is of the essence. The very idea of the warm handoff is to make the transition from one level of care to consistent treatment course, to make it seamless, to make it smooth, and to make it fast.
So, Helen, based on what you're saying, do people who go through warm handoffs tend to stay longer in treatment programs? What's the impact there?
Yes. The first step is that they even start treatment.
So just getting them into the program.
Exactly. In the past, what the emergency department, for example, would do, just say, okay, you need to continue with treatment. At the very best, they would say, contact this or that or whatever agency. And then the patient is out of there and there's no follow-up, and more often than not, he doesn't. But with a warm handoff, the very fact that he agrees to speak to a certified recovery specialist and then enters the treatment and they would follow up, this in itself is a success. And I can give you some numbers showing what a big difference it makes. For example, in Armstrong, Indiana, Clarion counties, we have a program called Addiction Recovery Mobile Outreach Team, ARMWOT. And according to their data, 81% of those who had been contacted by their CRS actually entered treatment. 85% of those assessed went to treatment directly from the hospital. Over a half of those who entered the treatment completed it. And also people who are involved emphasize that even someone has not completed the treatment after a warm handoff, very often he will reconnect with the program later on when he is ready to proceed. So all these steps certainly work better with a warm handoff.
Helen, you've been giving us some nice statistics broken down by county. If listeners are interested, they can go to Joint States website, and those breakdowns by county with specific numbers, percents, are available there with a wider breakdown. So I just want to let people know that that's available. And that's one of the things that, Helen, you guys spent a lot of time pulling together, and it's a nice data resource.
Thank you for your comment, Susan. We do want our reports to be helpful to particular legislators and just the population of Pennsylvania. Our report does have a lot of statistical information showing the number of overdose cases by county, showing specific agencies working in a particular county. We had a wonderful expert on statistics, Frank Lill, who were working on this report. He did a lot of work on Pennsylvania data. We also have specific data about agencies in your county. We actually have a full list of single county authorities with their phone numbers. So if you or your family member is interested in these programs, you can just call them directly. And they will tell you what your options are, and the options really exist.
That's great. Thank you, Helen.
To follow up with that, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about how family members can assist with the warm handoff process and just how they fit into this picture.
Thank you for the question, Brian. Families are certainly very important. Anyone who has a friend or a family member with a substance use disorder knows what a huge impact it has on the family. So if you don't mind, I'll start with the impact of the families. And the reason I'm doing it is because certainly overdose itself presents immediate danger, especially to children. There were cases when a parent overdosed in the presence of the child. It can also actually be a barrier in the warm handoff process, because say you are a police officer or an EMS provider, you give naloxone to the patient. What are you going to do then? You are leaving a patient in a precarious condition with a child at his side or her side, which is also dangerous. Even if the parent at this point is interested in a warm handoff, there are problems. What's going to happen with the child if, for example, this is a live-in program? Or, by the way, some parents are concerned about losing their parental rights if they are found in this position with a child. So what basically happens is that a lot of these overdoses are actually fatal, and the number of fatal overdoses has been growing for years and years. I can just give you an example. This is the CDC data. 20 years ago, less than 1,000 deaths a year were attributed to fentanyl and synthetic opioids. In 2017, more than 1,000 Americans died from synthetic opioid overdoses every 2 weeks. What can people do? Everybody knows that substance use disorder requires the involvement of the whole family in a positive way to be successful. People who really want to recover need support. Specifically with warm handoffs, it has been noticed that if a family member is involved at the first step, say if someone is in the emergency room with his spouse or parent or significant other, and that other person participates in the conversation, inducing the patient to accept treatment, success is much, much higher. But even later on, many of the programs I mentioned earlier work with the entire family, so they can try to keep the family involved at all points. For example, in Bucks County, BCARES, which is one of the most successful programs, has a so-called enhancement called family contact, and they really work with families making them involved at every step, because as you all know, substance use disorder treatment is a long-term process.
Helen, you've been giving us some great information about the increase in the instance of substance abuse disorder. It's kind of drawing my mind towards the current pandemic, wondering how COVID is impacting this topic. I know in your report you cite a special issue brief from the American Medical Association where they express concern about the increase in opioid use and mortality during the pandemic. Could you speak to that just a little bit?
Absolutely, Susan. I'm glad you raised this question because it is certainly on everyone's mind. Unfortunately, the pandemic has affected everyone in every way, and it has certainly affected people with substance use disorder. We have to wait for the final statistics, but the prior data have certainly shown that drug use, alcohol use has increased exponentially. So did overdose. There are really several aspects to it, why it has become the position of people with substance use disorder even more challenging. It's not surprising that people who have already done it before would use drugs more often because there's a lot of stress, as you can imagine. If this used to be their way to cope, that's what they would do in these circumstances even more than before. At the same time, they are at a higher risk. Some drug use specialists were hoping that because drug markets would be disrupted by the pandemic, people would have difficulty accessing drugs, so they would abuse drugs less. But that's not what happened. What happened is that because traditional markets have been disrupted, people start getting drugs from unknown sources. They are actually at a higher risk of getting some dangerous combination. We haven't talked about it yet in our conversation, but one of the most dangerous trends now is wider use of fentanyl, which increases mortality multiple times, right? So what happens is people are taking drugs, not knowing what's in them, not having their old reliable provider. So the risk of overdoses are higher also because they are isolated. Very often they are using drugs alone. So there is nobody next to them to call 911 or give them naloxone or do something. We should also say that there are medical factors that make COVID more dangerous for people with substance use disorder. Some of them are purely physiological, especially with opioids. It's well known that opioids affect lungs and cardiovascular system. And this is what COVID attacks as well. So people with substance use disorder have more difficult, more challenging cases of COVID if they do catch it. At the same time, people with substance use disorder lose some of the access to programs and treatment they had before. Many agencies simply had to close, right, to shut down completely. Sometimes it's possible to get help remotely, and I must say that both the national organizations and the Department of Drugs and Alcohol Program here took steps to use telemedicine to provide some help remotely, but that is certainly promising, but it poses its own challenges. So really, what we are seeing is that the need in substance use treatment is higher during the pandemic, but the access to treatment at the same time has been limited, has been reduced. So it is certainly a serious challenge. But to say something positive, on the other hand, because new ways, new approaches were tried, and some of them were successful, they may actually be promising for the future.
Thanks, Helen. You mentioned that some positive things have arisen, some new ways of dealing with things. Can you tell us what are the next steps? Where do we go from here?
If you mean something that emerged during the pandemic, that would be mostly telemedicine and remote prescription of buprenorphine in particular. If you mean in general the warm handoff process, what we need to do is to keep developing the system that has already emerged in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has actually been ahead of some other states in various aspects of treating substance use disorder. Pennsylvania was one of the first to broadly use naloxone. It was one of the states to broadly use medical assistant treatment in the system of corrections. Basically, there should be more providers available, as I said before, because even the smoothest process and the best developed process can't work if there are no places to send patients to for treatment. The plan for Pennsylvania, in the view of the advisory committee, would basically be to continue with this system, to develop it even further. Pennsylvania was one of the pioneers in the development of the warm handoff process, actually. The Department of Health, the Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs, and the Pennsylvania College of Emergency Physicians collaborated to develop the warm handoff protocol. This protocol has been implemented broadly throughout the Commonwealth and has been successful, though certain areas require enhancement and improvement, especially at the level of centers of excellence, for example. There needs to be enhancement, otherwise they won't be able to handle everything. The report also gives specific recommendations. One of the key points is to have consistency in offering warm handoffs to the entire population of the Commonwealth, and at the same time to have flexibility based on local circumstances, because they are very, very different in different parts of our states, as you know.
That was going to be something I wanted to bring up, is just if there's any other recommendations that you would like to highlight. In the report, you tailor them to what specific groups can do, such as the general public or emergency departments, treatment providers, or even other first responders.
Thank you for this question, Brian. It's always important to see who is supposed to be doing what. In the warm handoff process, actually, what we have heard from all parties is that it is critical that roles are defined very specifically. So this is in itself a recommendation, to state very clearly, to have a protocol. What does the R do? What does the CRE do? What does everyone else do? So that the patient wouldn't fall between the cracks. Some recommendations that I believe are most important based on our discussions with the advisory committee would be to expand the concept of a warm handoff to include any substance use disorder, not just opioids, for tracking, funding, and education purposes. For example, COEs, Centers for Excellence, at this point, deal only with opioids. They say themselves that they need to include other substances. There needs to be testing, and this is really more about the emergency room. Routine clinical toxicology testing should include specifically fentanyl and alcohol. And I must say the Department of Health is doing a lot to track overdose and give information to the interested parties. They have a syndromic surveillance system called Epicenter, which provides real-time data from the ER and sends this data to stakeholders. This is very important. Other recommendations, broader recommendations, would be to prioritize the long-term comprehensive approach to substance use treatment, including medication-assisted treatment, peer support, counseling, and social services. It can only be successful when it is comprehensive, when it addresses different challenging areas in the patient's life. And medication-assisted treatment seems to be particularly important, especially starting this medication-assisted treatment in the emergency room. They are willing to do that. They will need help with that. But if you start a patient on buprenorphine, say, at the emergency department, and then connect him to smoothly transition to treatment once he's out, it has been shown to be very effective in studies both in the United States, in Britain, in Australia, in some other countries. Maybe I should mention one more thing, which would be to incorporate harm reduction measures into each step of the warm handoff process. This is again about preventing another overdose, about preventing bad things from happening. I am actually very keen on prevention. I always look at that in whatever project I am involved in. But in this case, those harm reduction measures in the warm handoff process, for example, would include providing a patient with naloxone, maybe even two doses of naloxone, one for himself, one for family members. Provide an incarcerated person who is being released with naloxone, again, to connect him with the services outside.
Thanks, Helen, for giving us a better understanding of the need or the importance of warm handoffs for that. It's time for us to wrap up our conversation on House Resolution 620. Helen, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your conversation and your explanation of this issue.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for joining us as well. Our website has the full report, and Helen has pulled together so much data. She gave you a brief sampling or a couple of counties out of all of the data that she has. There's also a full list of recommendations. We touched on several of them, but the report contains more detailed recommendations. Our website is jsg.legis.state.pa.us. So please feel free to visit the website and check out the specifics of the report. Music on our podcast today was provided by Joseph McDade. Thank you all for joining us and have a good day.